The International Exhibition, Part 1, the 1997 Venice Biennale. And this is part of the soundtrack of a video projected work in Corderia titled Anahita's Swinging by Pipilotti Rist. Pavilion now with Rachel White-Reed, and we're in the first room, the large room as you come in, and the piece you've installed here, Rachel, is called Untitled, in brackets, 10 Tables. And what occurred to me, looking at all the titles, was that there's a sort of specificity and an unspecificity in the title, because they start off by you using the term untitled, and I thought that that's really an interesting aspect of the work. It's a presence and an absence, or a set of presences and a set of absences. But should we start by you talking about this piece, 10 Tables?
Yeah. Well, maybe if you're looking for a sort of explanation with the titling, I can explain it quite simply. When I first started making sculpture, I was very specific in the titles, and I became, you know, as time went on, I realised that what I was doing by sort of titling the pieces was sort of naming them and making people look at them in a very particular kind of way. And so I thought that I'd really kind of cut it down and pare it down to the minimum, but wanting something a little bit more than just untitled. You know, I think it's important to give some kind of clue. So this is, as you say, untitled, 10 tables in brackets, and that's really just an explanation of sort of what the piece is. What I did with this piece, I chose 10 identical tables that would either be used in a sort of classroom or a boardroom or a place where, you know, people gather to meet occasionally, you know, and they come together and then the tables are broken apart again. So I used this as a kind of unit of that I could repeat, and so I had the 10 tables, turned them upside down, and worked out this very complex mould. So the whole piece looks quite like a sort of Chinese puzzle or something. But it's also, I think, without sounding too sort of obtuse, it's almost like archaeology, and it's like sort of looking down into sort of excavations of a building or something. You know, it's like a truncated building.
Yeah, the idea of archaeology certainly comes to mind. I mean, they almost look like sites that have been unearthed. They have a sort of strange reference to objects and people. One of the things that I see as something quite common in a lot of the works is that they refer to the individuals, except that individuals are absent. You know, people sit at tables. The other objects that you've got here, there's a sense of the human being or the absence of a human being. Is that something that you feel is always necessary, to have that sort of reference to the human scale or the human being, rather than
it's certainly how the work has developed, and I mean that may change in the future, but I do like to work with the reference of sort of human scale, and I think that probably just simply started from working solely on my own in the studio and sort of practically kind of moving things around. But it's actually what I feel most comfortable with, and the way that you know, some of the pieces I make are very large, but they all break down into sort of small, manageable components. I enjoy that way of sort of fitting things together. And, you know, after all, everything that I make is made from, you know, an object that is very much part of our lives, you know, whether it's a table or a bed or a bath or a room or a house, you know, it's...
Rather than a sort of an abstract form. I mean, they always have that reference back to life.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, some of the sort of simplest pieces in this particular exhibition, say, for an untitled double plinth, that's a piece which is taken from the space underneath the mortuary slab, but it's actually kind of a kind of invented space, you know, it's not really... that it's partly that space, but I changed it, and I was wanting to find a way of making a block, making a plinth, but to But by making these sort of plinths using a material, this very sort of ephemeral material, this yellow rubber, which is almost, which is there and sort of not there, and it does amazing things with the light in this pavilion. And
We'll go into that room in a minute. But finally, about the piece we're looking at, the 10 table piece, was that made specifically for Venice, for this gallery?
Actually not. I mean, I was asked to, I think 6 months before this exhibition, I was asked to do it. And I actually was making this piece at the time, and I had no, I just moved studios, and I had no place that I was necessarily thinking of this piece to go. But when I came here to have a look, I felt it was very clear that it would handle the sort of largest room in the gallery.
Okay, on a general note, before we move, one of the things that I was looking forward to was seeing how the work worked in this particular place, location, given the particular quality of light. Now that you've installed the show, how do you feel it works in that sense?
You know, for me, it's the perfect kind of light conditions and perfect gallery space. And it's exactly the sort of scale that I like to work on. And, you know, working with this fantastic kind of Venetian bright light. I've just did a show at the Palacio Velázquez in Madrid, and that came down a couple of months ago. And again, you know, I had no electric light at all. And it's, you know, it's a great opportunity and very rare to actually be able to show like that.
Yeah, I know the plaster actually resonates. It's almost has a sort of a luminescence.
It kind of sings with the light, you know. There's just, yeah, I think it works very well.
Right. Shall we move to the space over there? Now we've moved to this slightly smaller gallery, and it's the piece here is called Untitled Double Rubber Plinth. And it's made, in fact, from a sort of yellowish ochre rubber, isn't it? Two pieces.
Yeah, I was looking for a material that was sort of similar to a kind of wax or honey or something like this. So I was wanting the material that was that with sunlight would sort of sing and resonate and sometimes sort of virtually disappear, sometimes sort of come back. So when the light changes in these rooms, you know, this can be very sort of dense or it can look very airy and light.
And you mentioned that their spaces cast from beneath mortuary slabs?
That's right. They're actually taken from the ceramic ends that hold up a mortuary slab. And I used that to begin to make the mould and then sort of invented two of the sides. And I was looking for a way of making a plinth, basically. I was looking for a way for making a block. And I didn't just want to make a kind of square block. I wanted it to have some other reference, some other source. And I'd had these mortuary slabs in the studio for a long time, used them for various other pieces, but never managed to use the bases, and then found this way of doing it.
I think we spoke about a piece you made using them at the last Documenta.
Indeed we did, yes, I remember it very well. Similar sort of circus.
Should we move to the next room? And this piece, a very impressive piece, it's called Untitled, in brackets, Paperbacks, and it immediately made me think of your model for the Viennese Holocaust Monument. Are there specific links there, do you think?
Of course, yeah, with the Holocaust Memorial, there's been a lot of problems, a lot of things which are, you know, really been out of my control. And it's left me feeling very, very frustrated. What I decided to do when I was asked to work in the pavilion was to make a piece specifically for the galleries. And because of my frustrations with Vienna, I felt it was important to actually somehow try and resolve some of those frustrations, and decided to make a piece that's actually not, it's almost like an inverse of what would happen in Vienna. But it's cast in plaster, and it's a cast of thousands and thousands of paperbacks, second-hand books, new books, and made to fit the room.
Right. And the book, of course, is, again, a very resonant object, isn't it? In that it represents a body of knowledge, it represents a certain sort of human usage. It's an object, it's commonplace within all our lives.
Yeah, I mean, everybody is so sort of familiar with books, and that you know, a well-thumbed book is a well-loved book. You know, everybody has this you know, clear relationship with books.
Well, now we're in the back space here in the pavilion, looking at a piece that is receiving direct sunlight, in fact. It's untitled Resin Corridor, and we mentioned the last documentary, and this one is sort of reminiscent of the piece you had there, casts from underneath the underside of floorboards.
Yeah, that piece in documentary was the first floor piece that I made, and I think since, you know, I tend to make work in series, you know, somehow there's generally a few on the same sort of theme. This piece is cast in resin, and it's the space, again, underneath floorboards. It's in nine sections, and it's called Untitled Corridor. So it has a sense of a place that you might pass through rather than being a room. And it's this dense sort of aquatic resin, which the piece is placed in the back gallery next to the canal. And it was something that I was very clear about when I first came to look at the pavilion, that the way the water is almost in the building, and to so therefore reflect that with this piece and to sort of draw a parallel between the two.
The colour that it seems to have now does relate very closely, I think, to the sort of colour of the water, as you say, out in the canals, very deep, resonant blue-green. Which changes, I've seen it a few times.
Yeah, well, I mean, when this piece is, again, it's something that works very well with natural light, you know, and if there's bright sun coming through the piece, it sort of partially disappears in parts and you get sort of drawn into it and the colour changes. It becomes, you know, the mass of the piece. These pieces are solid, then they don't have any sort of core or hole in the centre of them. They're absolutely solid. And you get drawn into that solidity and you can sort of sense that it's...
Although they're cast from the underside of floorboards, they nevertheless still seem to bear the trace of time in the way that they're slightly irregular, and also of the passage of people over them and wear and tear.
Exactly. I mean, with this piece, it was cast in the studio, and then I sort of worked on it in a different kind of way, and it was really to do with getting the sense of a worn space, a worn place.
And like some of the other pieces, there's a sense of the object's history embedded within its presence.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if you look at the surface of the piece, you can see that there's a sort of time element in the way that it's being cast. And it's cast in maybe about 20 pours over a period of 2 or 3 weeks. Some of the resin pieces even have things like flies in them, you know, so they're like amber trapping the fly. So, that, you know, in the sense that there's a sense of time in the way that the piece has been built up, but I think there's also a sense of time in the way the piece looks worn, and as it looks as if it's been a sort of thoroughfare for people for centuries.
You know. Right, which gives it a whole set of other associations, which I presume you are interested in holding in the piece.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't tend to like to really talk about these... The way I think about a piece of work and the way someone else might think about a piece of work could be entirely different. So I don't really like to sort of push my ideas in that way, which is really coming back to the titling and how things aren't really that specific.
Right, well, shall we move now to the next room, which has a piece called Untitled, in brackets, Orange Bath. And again, it's just at the end of this corridor. And this is another material, isn't it?
This is cast in an orange polyurethane rubber, and it's cast in a way that it sort of has these striations on the surface of the piece, so it looks like maybe marble or some kind of rock. Sorry. This piece, Untitled Orange Bath, is cast in a polyurethane rubber, and it's an orange rubber which, by using different methods of sort of whipping or whisking the rubber, you can change the coloration of it, which is how I've sort of controlled the surface of this piece. So it looks like maybe onyx or marble. It has these very dense areas and then it has a much lighter area. And if you touch it, which you're not supposed to, but people do all the time, it has a completely different sense of it. It's sort of soft and rather than hard and cold.
It sort of has a certain sense of the monumental about it too. I'm reminded of tombs that one sees in places like the British Museum.
I mean, that's exactly what I sort of had in mind whilst I was making this piece. I'd made a number of bath pieces before, and this piece, I was wanting to make, you know, I'd made them in plaster, sorry. I'd made a number of bath pieces before in plaster, and I wanted to sort of readdress that and make it in another material, which was completely unmonumental, but actually working in that way.
So there's a sort of contradiction.
Yes,
there,
so
almost,
yeah.
Which gives us another.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we might as well go out just to finish. Again, the bath is immediately suggestive of a human being, but this ambiguity between the idea of a bath and a tomb, I think, is gives the piece quite a bit of tension. So, Rachel, we're in the last room, looking at a piece called Table and Chair, in brackets, Clear. Can you talk a little bit about this piece?
This piece was the first resin piece that I made, and when I'd been experimenting with sort of rubbers and plasters, and wanted to use a material that had incredibly dense quality, but so many of my pieces have had, you know, the inside, you don't see the insides of the pieces. They're opaque. The pieces are opaque, but with the resin, I was wanting to use a material that you actually kind of looked into the piece and you were drawn into the interior of the object of the block. So this piece is, it was the first kind of experiment, I think, using, well, it was definitely the first experiment using resin. Very, very difficult material to use, and I sort of persevered with it and managed to get it to work in this way. And so it has a sense, this piece has a sense where there was a chair that was pushed underneath the table, and that's sort of been removed. So you have the space where the chair was as if you were sitting at a desk.
Sometimes the nature of the object can be quite ambiguous. I've found myself, you know, trying to, I know that they relate to an object in the real world, but sometimes it's a bit of a puzzle to work out what you've actually done in relation to the object in the real world. So one reading of them could be just purely as a formal piece of sculpture, you know, a minimalist piece of sculpture. That avoidance of an obvious sort of link in some cases, I presume, is intentional.
I think all of the pieces, you know, they can be seen as either, as you said, sort of minimal works, or they have the resin table and chair piece, it could essentially be seen as a sort of minimal object, but in fact there's something a lot more complex going on. And I think it's the way the work, when the work works best, it's when there is that sort of ambiguity, where it can be seen as just a very straightforward sort of block of stuff, or you can look into it and you find all sorts of other things going on. But interestingly though, this piece was probably, when I made it, the most sort of complicated piece that I'd made, because I'd never used silicon moulds before, and the actual table was cast from a table, but the chair had to be cast from a silicon mould. So it was a much more kind of complicated working process. I think this piece is about 4 years old now, but it was quite an important piece for me in terms of changing my sort of technical attitude towards how things were cast.
Again, there are references here that to do with house, the piece house, where what you're presumably doing is not making a representation that can be recognised as such, that might correspond with, say, a photographic representational image of the subject, but it's more based on the residue of memory, an experience of inhabiting a space, and we, you know that the space is beneath, say, the level of a table we use, but we don't ever depict them. Whereas your pieces somehow deal with these areas which are embedded in the memory but don't have actual images necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first table piece that I made, it was simply about trying to give that place an authority, that place that one forgets, one knows about but forgets. You put your legs under there and it's not, you know, you maybe store things under there, whatever. And it was really to do with somehow bringing that space into the world, or, but, you know... And now, the space that I use has now become a kind of an object in a sculptural a part of my sculptural language. And it's, you know, I've made many pieces now with tables, and it's really, I think, for me, the table can look like a building, it can look like a table, it can look like a block, it can look like, there's so many different things which I personally read into this object that I've kind of invented, I suppose. So for me, it's a very sort of rich area, and it's something that I think I'll probably continue using, as it's almost like a building block. I've now made it into a kind of building block for my sort of pieces.
Should we finish by just going back to the book piece and perhaps to the Vienna project? Where is that at now? Is it completely not going to happen in Judaplatz, or is it still open?
Well, we're sort of in a deadlock. I'm not sure what's going to happen. I've been told that they wanted it to be somewhere else, in a place called Heroesplatz, which is would be like putting the piece in St James's Park. I mean, it's sort of completely wrong. So I've said I've absolutely refused to let that happen. But I think they were really just using that as an excuse. And there's a very, very strong political battle going on. And people say it's to do with ideologies and all sorts of things. But it's really, I think the whole idea of making this was an experiment for the Viennese to see what would happen. And I've been used as part of that experiment. Hopefully the piece will happen, but I really don't know.
All of your pieces are site-specific in one sense or another, or at least they link with your own experience. So, I mean, in that sense, it's not a question of just putting it somewhere else. I mean, it's very specifically for that.
No, that piece is absolutely specifically for that square. But saying that, you know, if the piece doesn't happen there, you know, I certainly wouldn't let it go anywhere else in Austria. But, you know, I may decide, OK, well, let's see if we can locate it somewhere and try and find the right sort of place for it, or adjust the piece somehow or whatever. But I feel absolutely that in Austria, if they don't have it in that square, then they don't have it at all. So, but I really, you know, I worked very hard and was very thoughtful about how the piece would locate in, you know, and I wasn't insensitive to the surroundings. But obviously, you know, you can't make a piece of public sculpture through consensus. You know, it's impossible. You don't, you know, it's one doesn't, no one could. I mean, with House, if we'd had, if we'd opened it to public opinion before it was built, it would never have been built. I mean, it only stood for 2 months anyway. You know, it's just, it just doesn't work like that. So, the way I feel at the moment, I'll just let the Viennese just fight it out between themselves. We're at Viennese, yeah, that's right. I keep getting Venice and Vienna mixed up. Let the Viennese sort it out between themselves.
Is there any final thing you want to say about your experience of doing this Biennale?
It's actually been a terrific experience. The British Council have been amazing and looked after the whole thing impeccably. And it was a real pleasure to make the book room, which, you know, for me was a kind of release and a way, as it was quite cathartic, you know, a way of actually making something that I've been trying to make for, you know, 2 years now.
Well, I'm now outside the Dutch Pavilion with the curator of the exhibition. Could you tell us who you are and then perhaps talk a little bit about the selection of artists in this pavilion?
Yes. Well, my name is Leontien Koelewey. I'm curator at the Stedelijk Museum of Modern Art in Amsterdam. And I run the Bureau Amsterdam, which is a satellite of the Stedelijk, especially for younger Dutch artists. And this show in the Dutch Pavilion I made together with Arno van Roosmalen. He's curator at the Boijmans Museum. And we have chosen two Dutch artists for this exhibition. And their names are Arnoud Mick and Willem Orebeek. We have chosen them because we think they're really interesting, very important artists at this moment in Holland. But also because we wanted to do a very special project, especially here for this pavilion.
So both of the installations have been made specifically for the pavilion?
Yes, that's right. You know, the pavilion, it was built in 1945 by the Dutch architect Gerard Rietveld. And it's a simple modernist, late modernist building. It's a simple cube with very white and a lot of light in it. But it's also got a very strange hierarchy. It's got a sort of wall of honor. And both the artists wanted to do something with the pavilion. They wanted to, like, introduce a new way of, like, moving through the space and trying to sort of break down this whole hierarchy. So their work is very different. Willem Orebeek makes work that's directly on the wall. It's printed on paper. Sometimes they're like patterns of dots, and sometimes you can see images of people there from magazines. And Arnoud Mick, he makes sculptural works, installations, and video works. So on the one hand, the work is very different, but they share a common, like, feeling of dealing with the architecture.
Have there been any special considerations that you've had to take into account making this exhibition here in Venice? Because it is a very particular sort of place, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we know that both the artists are conscious of the whole situation, but they didn't want to comment on Venice or anything like that, because that would be a little bit, like, too narrow. They're more interested in the way you are in the pavilion, the way you move through the pavilion. Things like perception, or more the physicality of being there, are more important for them than Venice and the Biennial as an institution itself.
As a curator, though, I mean, what do you think the function and role of a Biennale such as this on such a grand scale now within international context and contemporary art in particular? I mean, do you think it serves a very particular function, or?
Well, we all know that it's a very, like, old-fashioned institute. In a way, it's a sort of anachronism now, 1997, with all these national pavilions. But on the other hand, there are still, like, countries who try to do something special within their pavilions. Perhaps even more now, because we all started very late, so we all had to sort of improvise and make an exhibition within 4 months. I still think that you can see some interesting works here. But, yeah, every country deals with this whole Venice Biennale thing.
So now I'm talking to Willem Orebeek in the Dutch Pavilion. And Willem, you have a series of wall installations. Generally, it's the image that you see when you blow up some printing,
yes,
on a hoarding.
Yes.
But onto that, there are three images, two girls and a child, photostat images, looking out at us. Perhaps you could talk about the general concerns of this piece.
Yeah, in general, I base myself on already printed material. I'm enlarging existing and public images. The consequence of this is, of course, that it deals with the representation which is already existing in the media that they printed in. In the same time, dealing with the problem of representation, that's my main concern. Since 1994, I quit making objects that are transportable from one place to the other. I once decided to glue my images on the surface of the exhibition space, and to avoid the idea of an unnatural frame, I used the wall from corner to corner. All of the pieces in this pavilion are made for this location, for this exhibition, together with Arnoud Mick.
So it's interesting what you say about wanting to use imagery that is already, in a sense, publicly owned or publicly familiar.
What I do is take these images that I'm interested in, or that for a specific reason I want to use, take them out of this context and use them for a kind of delay in this flow of images that surround us daily.
One thing that happens, I think, with this piece, and I think it's called the Benday dot system that's used in printing to kind of break up colour into primary colours, is that something that surrounds us all and that we handle every day, that is ephemeral, presented here on the scale that you presented it, and the way you've actually magnified the dot patterns, it makes the surface of this wall monumental.
Not only monumental, but also problematic because of the scale and because of the rosettes that are visible in the double grid.
What about the actual iconography of two girls and a child?
Well, I've been interested in using images of figures that have a sort of life-size intention, looking at a camera. They're also posing in a way that they're expecting something from you. Either they're waiting just before the moment that something happening as an interaction between the spectator and the figures. And the figures, of course, can't move. I mean, it's already a second-use image.
So we're facing on the opposite wall of the gallery, which runs right across it. It's almost black, but it's not. I can see some intervention. Should we walk over?
Yes. It's entirely plain black printed sheets of paper. What you discover on this black wall is a kind of memory image of what you've seen before. You have to move to see the images, because seeing the images is depending on the reflection of light. So if you see one image, you almost see not more than the two or three images surrounding this one image, and you have to move to be able to see all the other images.
So with the two artists in the pavilion, is there a particular reason why they're located together? Or?
I still don't know. I think it's interesting, but it depends on your experience of what you see and what you can relate. I think it's a respectful not cooperation. I mean, we both respect each other's work, but we from the beginning decided not to interfere in each other's work. The only thing I did was in two walls I've printed some screens so that he could project on a black wall of mine.
I'm at the Austrian Pavilion now with Peter Weibel, and Peter, you've organized the installation in this pavilion, which comprises an enormous stack of books which deal with a particular period in Austrian art from 1954 to 1960. So in fact it's a research project in a way, it's a project of documentation. Why did you decide to install this group of books in the pavilion?
The visual and actionistic work of the Vienna Group, which consists of about five people, is nearly neglected on a national level and completely unknown on an international level. And the question was, how can you function as an archive today when you try to reconstruct happenings or events which have been done in the 50s? Yeah? Can you reproduce them by photographic documents and then blow them up? Can you make vitrines and show in these vitrines some residuals from events? Yeah? Or should you go forward and say what the artist did was to use the letters and the page like a visual artist is using a canvas. And my idea is that these artists, which are coming from music or coming from literature, in fact use the page as an artistic medium comparable to a wall or an easel painting. And therefore I realized it would not make sense to take all the small photo montages, not much larger than a normal book page, not to put them on the wall, but to leave them in the book, because this is not to to confuse with the traditional art book, which I also estimate very much, to make the book as an object. This book is not an object, this is a book, a storage, as archive, but the page is the artwork itself. So the book is like a room which has 800 walls. And each of these walls is traditionally called a page. I had to be very careful about the paper, about the printing process. And the book now, in the age of electronics mediation, in the future of the book, in the post-industrial media age, is something discussed and questioned. What is the function of CD-ROM? What is the function of the book? What is the function of the net? And have now new information media, new storage media, new communication media. I thought it was the book itself has a historically definable face, and I think this is just the right moment to use the book as artistic medium. And now comes then the point, normally the book is a multiple, so I had to make a mass edition, it's 50,000, But it's only here, and only here is free. So when you want to get the book, you must come to Venice, like you have to go to see the Mona Lisa. If you want a print of Mona Lisa, you can see it anywhere. But to see the original, yeah? So it's a contradiction. You have a mass media, 50,000, but you see them only here, and you get them here for free. When the show is over, the book will not be on the market, but we have a CD-ROM. And I always say a CD-ROM is an extension of the book in the acoustic and the motion dimensions. So after the show is over, you can have a hardcover copy of the book together with CD-ROM. At the same time, the material of the book and much more, like film interviews, video clips, sound clips, are in the net. We have a worldwide web environment where we have a digital simulation of the Pamlio. So the book is the first book in the world history which has not only the barcode and another ISBN number, it has also the net account on the cover. So from the book already, it's a self-referential indication that the material of the book and much more you can find in a worldwide web environment. So in the main room, we have the historical form of a book, the paper book, and two small additional rooms, we have futuristic forms of the book, like CD-ROM or net.
Two things. One is, you mentioned in passing that people can actually take away a copy of this book, and the book is a very thick, substantial, heavy object. That's one thing. So it's interactive in the sense of it's a participatory work, in that people can take away a book, and this huge stack will gradually reduce, I imagine, over the period of the Biennale. That's one thing that I think is interesting. But the other is the period that you've chosen to describe in the book and to document in the book, 1954 to 1960. Tell me about that, because it might be that you would have, say, chosen a group of contemporary artists working now.
To be commissioned as the Austrian Pavilion is something very special, because Austria has a very difficult past. We have now the Second Republic, and the time between 1918 and 1945, we had the First Republic. The First Republic was very fascist. So the Vienna Circle of logical thinkers, the new Vienna School of Music like Schoenberg, all of these modernist movements until Freud have been thrown out. But the same people who had been in power before the war still have been in power after the war. So this is my first thesis, which is called continuum hypothesis. No? So that the Austrian fascism was also prevailing after Second World War. So when a group came up, like the Vienna Group, a group of artists, writers, and poets, and they called themselves Vienna Group, it was in clear relation to the Vienna Circle of philosophers and to Schoenberg's and Webern's and Berg's circle of a new Vienna School of Music. So naturally, had no chance to publicate. They only could publicate 10 years later in Germany. Yeah? But the visual work from the 50s and the actionistic work was never published adequately. Small presses showed some fragments. Yeah? So it's the first time now that you could show this unknown and this neglected work of the Vienna Group. And I call it a subtitle, A Moment of Modernity. It was the first and most decisive moment of modernism in Austria. Austria in the First Republic was a wall of mediocrity around Austria. There was no modernist movement at all in the First Republic. So everything that we had was kind of expressionism, which was died 1980, yeah? Because then died Schiele and Klimt and all these people. No? Afterwards, it was just mediocre cultural landscape besides science, but everything was thrown out. After 1945, all this, it was continuous, these expressive exhibitions. The same curator who was curator, like Josef Hofmann, 1934, was the curator afterwards. So 6 years ago, I started with this pavilion commissioner and called it Transnational Pavilion, because I invited not only one Austrian artist and two foreigners, an American and a Swiss artist, to reflect the history of the pavilion. 2 years ago, I invited the deconstructivist architect, Kurt Himmelblau, to restructure as a building the pavilion. And now, after this kind of symbolic clearance, I could say, now let's show as a group which is really modern. And I think it's the only modernist movement we have in Austria, which is clearly modern. And you can only compare it with some European groups like Independent Group in England in the 50s or the International Sittonist from France and in Europe. So I try to reintroduce, not only in Austria, but also in the European idea of modernity, some important contributions. Because I think one of the consequences of the Marshall Plan was that we have a wrong image of the 50s, which is we only think about Dashism and informal and effect expressionism. So it's still a demonstration of American hegemony, yeah? The victory countries over European defeated countries. Yeah? And I start now on this international forum to debate what are the real European contributions to the 50s. It's not only abstract expressionism, it's not only fascism and things like this, informalism. It's also very early contributions to formal, calculated, rational arts. And therefore, I've selected this group because now is a very good moment, not only on an international level, but also a national level, to show a fundament of what I would say more or less the only relevant Austrian culture.
One of the characteristics of this area of practice, which I imagine is one of the reasons why perhaps it's become invisible, is a lot of it was temporary, a lot of it was performance-based. It didn't actually end in physical objects. So in a way, you've kind of reappropriated it, you've re-evaluated it.
The form of the presentation, this kind of immaterial presentation in book form, not art products in the classical sense, is exactly re-evaluating the spirit of the time. No? The time spirit was information is free, remember the 60s. I mean, these people had their hate around 1958, 1959, and I wanted to reintroduce the shock of modernity when you show something which is not easily equaled being art. Huh? So I don't show classical sculpture, classical painting, so I wanted to reintroduce this kind of a shock, give them something which is not ordinarily linked to conventional ideas of art.
And I think in a way it's particularly relevant to a younger generation of artists who seem to be very interested in this particular period in terms of its analysis, its arguments, its agendas, that perhaps goes beyond the sort of the object-making outcomes of the period. But there's definitely an interest amongst contemporary artists, and I wondered what your view was about that. I mean, how do you think it relates to younger artists working now?
I think that the most relevant contribution of younger artists is continuing critique of reality, by critique of the institutions which produce reality, by critique of the media which produce reality. So when we see that reality is more or less a product of construction and of representation strategies, then young artists start to criticize representations, strategies, and institutions. I give this movement a name, I called it context art. That means when you're not producing a text, a product, but when you're analyzing what are the conditions under which you produce an aesthetic object. So you don't produce a text, an object, you are investigating conditions under which you make art. And this, at that time, in the 50s and 60s, was called a fusion, art infusion. But in fact, the meaning was to dissolve by a microscopic look what are the mechanisms in the artist himself, in his consciousness, and in the society. So it's not this kind of naive expression, not the naive idea, I have a problem about to express it. So that art is this kind of expression of a subjective, idealistic view. The idea is now much more, what are the objective conditions under which art is produced, and what is then the mirror through which you can analyze hidden agenda of society. And I think the younger generation is doing exactly this.